Okay, good evening. I think we have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order at 6 o'clock. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cabot, and I'm the chair for the Northern REC, and I represent non-consumptive for Hooper. I'd like to go ahead and start by asking each of the REC members to introduce yourselves, and we'll start over there with Justin.
Justin Oliver, at large.
Robert Sanchez, Forest Service.
John Wall, at large, Riverdale.
Matt Clark, at large, Ogden.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
Kevin McLeod, public at large, West Haven.
Craig Van Tassel, sportsman representative from Camas.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, public at large.
Mike Lauder, sportsman's rep.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, at large.
Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife. I serve as the executive secretary and a non-voting member.
Okay, if you'll please join me in turning off your cell phones, turning off the ringers at least, so that we have an uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy, rules, and regulations. The council makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and sets the policy for all protected species in Utah. This meeting will be recorded, so please make sure you use the microphone when you're making any comments or addressing the speakers. I think everybody's had a chance to take a look at the agenda for tonight's meeting. If there is no objection, we'll go ahead and approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. There being no objection, then the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. The next business in order is the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting, and I think everyone should have received an email copy of the minutes. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are then approved as circulated. The next business in order is the Wildlife Board update, and Justin Doling will provide that report.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just kind of quickly go through the Wildlife Board summary of motions and kind of give you a feel for what happened there. The Cougar Management Plan, our RAC recommended it be adopted by the Wildlife Board. And essentially, the Wildlife Board did adopt 99.9% of the Cougar Management Plan with one addition, and that is they wanted to have mountain goats listed as a species that would come under consideration for predator management, particularly with new transplants that may occur in the future. The Cougar Rule recommendations and amendments, the RAC recommended that we accept that rule and move that recommendation onto the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board did change a few things in the course of their discussion. In particular, in our RAC, the hunting strategy for the cache unit went from a split strategy that the division was recommending to a harvest objective strategy. The permit numbers stayed the same. And then the board also adjusted permit numbers on some of the units outside of our region. The fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations were essentially approved as the RAC recommended, with the 1 week extension for bobcat and all species excluding, I believe it was beaver and mink. The AIS rule amendments essentially passed as presented. I know our RAC had some discussions about the the possibility to remove the permanent seal in the event that you go through a proper decontamination or if your boat has met the dry time requirements. And after further review of the rule at the board meeting, it appears that that's already been covered in the rule language. So they just moved that forward as recommended. And then the three rule amendments presented by law enforcement also all passed as recommended by the Northern RAC. And then the fee schedule, if you remember correctly, our RAC wanted to consider adding the multi-season fees to the fee schedule. The division at the board meeting indicated that was our plan for the upcoming year, and we'll do that next year. And so the fee schedule, which was no changes this year, passed as presented. So that's the update, unless anybody has any questions.
Justin, did they make the Bobcat season a permanent thing or just extend it for one more year?
Can you say that just a little louder?
Did they make the Bobcat thing permanent, the extra week, or did they just extend that for one more year?
It was just extended for this particular season. The Bobcat management plan is up for review this coming year, and based on the data that's been collected over the last 2 years, it looks like that one-week extension does allow for it shifts the harvest from females to males. So it'll probably be part of the working strategy for the new plan.
Any other questions on the wildlife update? I see that Sheriff Jensen just joined us. I was wondering if you could introduce yourself and indicate who you represent.
Oh, sure. Sorry, I was late.
No, you're fine.
County Council meeting. I'm Chad Jensen. I'm the sheriff of Cache County, and I've been asked to be on the board as the elected official.
Very good. Thank you. The next business in order is the regional update, and Justin Dowling, the regional supervisor, will provide the report.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to be brief on this one as well. In our wildlife section, we went through a recent reorganization of our Great Salt Lake ecosystem program. That program used to be centralized and supervised out of our Salt Lake office. It's now being supervised out of our regional office, and John Luft is the program manager. As also a part of that reorganization, we moved all the waterfowl management area personnel into the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem program. And so John Luft now oversees the supervision of the waterfowl refuges, Farmington Bay, Ogden Bay, and public shooting grounds in Salt Creek. So it's an exciting time for the Great Salt Lake. It's an incredible resource, and I think now we have kind of a good game plan and a good mechanism in place to deal with some of the upcoming issues associated with the lake. The waterfowl guys are working on frag control. In fact, they finished up last week spraying Phragmites on the WMAs. The gates will open for the waterfowl management areas on the 17th, and then our youth hunt will be on the 19th. So you've got a couple of days prior to the youth hunt to go out and scout and pick out a spot for a young man or woman to join you on the youth hunt. And we've started some new research up in the Cache County area on dusky grouse, working with the University of Utah, or excuse me, Utah State. And the guys just finished the survey of goats on Willard and counted 200 goats, which is about an 80%, we have about an 80% sightability. So we're still over objective on goats on Willard. As far as our habitat section, they're busy obtaining bids for new habitat projects. Work this fall will begin on projects located in Cache, West Box Elder County, and then also the North Slope. In our aquatic section, they're planning chemical treatment for Otter Creek. That's going to be the 21st and the 23rd, 21st through the 23rd of September. It's not only targeting native Bonneville cutthroat, but also leatherside chub. And so the plan is to go in and remove all the non-native fish and then bring Bonneville cutthroat back in and also leatherside chub. So if you have an interest in coming out and participating and observing that treatment, you're more than welcome to do that. And Paul Thompson or Chris Penny, who's in the audience here, can plug you into that project. The guys will also be working on June sucker transfers. We have a June sucker grow-out pond in West Box Elder County, actually a couple of ponds. And they are looking for some help September 28th, 29th, and 30th. Those fish are essentially seined out of the ponds and then moved to Utah Lake as part of that recovery effort for June sucker. So if you're interested, probably your best contact is Phil Tuttle. His phone number, if you have an interest, is 801-547-7440. And right now, I'm told that the Uintas are fishing well. And in particular, Beaver Lake above Whitney Reservoir is really, really hot. So a lot of those, you didn't hear me say that, but a lot of the reservoirs up in the Uintas right now are fishing really well. I was up at Whiskey Island Lake last week and just had a fabulous time catching Arctic grayling. So in our administrative section, we still are selling. We still have available our any bull unit or any bull permits, and also our spike only permits. So we've got somewhere between 5,000 to 6,000 any bull permits and about 7,000 spike only permits at this point. In our outreach section, they're planning for an upland game. The upland game workshop at Cache County went really well and was well attended, and folks learned a lot about upland game hunting. And that was held late last month. In our law enforcement section, they're planning for the Waterfowl Youth Fair, which is September 12th at Farmington Bay. And currently, the archery deer hunt is activity on the archery deer hunt is starting to pick up a bit. So that's all I have for our update, unless there's questions from the RAC.
Bryce, you said the Willard goats are overpopulation, and I know they passed that new management plan. Do you have any idea when they're going to start? I know they didn't want to do transplants, but reintroductions is kind of what I think Randy told me a while back. Do you have any idea when they're going to start those?
Well, it's my understanding that goat population is just naturally expanding. So we're just going to allow that to occur. And then when those subunits have populations that can withstand hunting, then we'll go ahead and allow permits in those areas.
So they don't have any plans on introducing
moving
new
them
populations
around.
Of goats?
Not
moving them around, but introduce. He said that they like to have new genes or new strains. They don't want to move them.
Well, I'd have to double check with Randy, but there are a group of goats that will be transplanted from Willard, I believe, and moved to Mount Dutton this fall. And then we've also increased our permits to try to keep that population closer to objective.
Yeah. But they don't have any plans on dispersing them, making them grow quicker in other parts of the unit.
When you say dispersing them within the kind of the larger Willard unit?
Well, yeah, like up here above Honeyville, Deweyville, or up above Logan Canyon, like in the new management unit, I guess.
Yeah. To my knowledge, we're not gonna pick them off Willard and then move them up there to the Wellsvilles. We're just gonna let them naturally disperse.
Any other questions for Justin? Chris.
Justin, a comment from one of the Wasatch Audubon members. Folks have definitely noticed the improvements that are happening for access at the north end of Ogden Bay. Moving of the gate and removing a completely useless and large patch of Phragmites. And so please pass along our appreciation to the folks that are ramrodding that effort, because it's really making things better to get into that north end of the bay.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. And we have a new manager out there at Ogden Bay, and I know he's going to set the world on fire. So I think you'll see a lot of changes occur at Ogden Bay. But I will pass that along, and thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. I'd like to go over for a second the procedure for tonight's meeting. The meeting will proceed with a representative of the Division of Wildlife Resources making a presentation on the agenda item. Then we will have questions from the public. That's only the time for questions. Comments will come later. We will then move to the RAC, which will have an opportunity to ask questions. Then we will move back to the public for comment on the agenda item. And persons that are representing themselves will have 3 minutes to comment, and persons representing a group will be allowed 5 minutes. In either case, we ask that you do put your information on a blue card and pass that over here so that we have a record of your comment. You may also fill out a blue card if you don't wish to address the RAC but would like to have a written comment, so we would welcome that as well. After the comment period from the public, we will then move back over to the RAC for comment, and then also any motions and votes on the wildlife or on the issue at hand. I'd like to remind that all the council members who wish to abstain from voting, we ask that you state your conflict for your abstention, and then also council members voting in opposition, we ask that you provide your rationale for that. So we will then go ahead and get started with the first agenda item, which is Fishing Guidebook and Rule R657-13, and this will be presented by Drew Cushing. Sorry.
Can everybody hear me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'd like to recognize Paul Birdsey. He's my counterpart. I'm the warm water sport fish coordinator. Paul Birdsey's the cold water sport fish coordinator. And I'd also like to recognize Chris Penny, who is standing in for Paul Thompson tonight, who couldn't be here. This is our annual effort to provide you with our recommendations for our fishing guidebook changes. These would be the changes for 2016. So about 4 or 5 years ago, we stopped doing the informational RAC, largely because the public didn't attend the informational RACs and we needed a better way to solicit input. So we did that by this online survey, and so we use it to gather angler input on proposed regulation changes. The survey generally runs 2 months. This year was a record number of people that responded. It was 1,800 people this last year, which is a lot of folks. The survey provided us with input on the regulation changes and also provided us with additional insight into other management questions, which we provided to our regional managers and regional management staffs so that they could know those and consider recommendations for changes in the future. So one of the questions we asked, we were contemplating some changes in our tiger muskie program. As you may or may not know, we're starting to raise and produce tiger muskies in-state. This last year, I think we ended up with around 10,000. So we feel pretty comfortable with our progress that we're making there and felt like a change in management of tiger muskies might be in the wind. So we asked them, first of all, how many people target tiger muskie. And this surprised us. 41% of the anglers surveyed indicated that they pursue tiger muskie annually. Most of the people are catch and release fishermen. They don't harvest tiger muskie. And then we suspected until this survey. And then we asked what a trophy tiger muskie was. So how long is a trophy tiger muskie? This was perplexing at first. 35% said that a 40-inch tiger muskie is a trophy. 30% said that 45 were trophy, and 31% said that 50 are trophy. We rolled this around and combined with the catch and release perspective and what people do with these fish, they largely catch them and release them. All tiger muskie are a trophy, regardless of their size. So one of the things that we, learned from this is that, like we suspected, most of our mortality in tiger muskie is catch and release mortality. Deep hooked fish, played long time, get in the boat, rough handled, and then they end up dying. There's not a lot of harvest that goes on with these fish, even for trophy fish, apparently. The other thing we're curious about are kokanee regulations. Our restrictions on kokanee during the spawn were all over the board, and we wanted to know whether people would support a standardized closure for possession of kokanee. And just to kind of, we worked with our regional managers on some dates, and they agreed that September 10th through November 30th would just about cover all of the concerns they had in their reservoirs. And the anglers actually supported this heavily. So another thing, this comes up annually. It's in the write-in section where we ask anglers every year, you know, is bait something you would consider using if it was legal? So we asked that question on our survey this year. Only 38% of the respondents said they would use corn if it was allowed as a bait. We would like to ask this question again in the future, but just ask bait fishermen, perhaps, you know, how many of those folks would be interested in using corn if it was allowed. This year, we're not moving forward with anything in this regard. All right. The other question we asked, the waterfowl has a SLAM that you, if you kill, you know, the species assemblage of waterfowl, that you complete a SLAM and you get a shotgun shell. There's an upland SLAM that I believe was enacted last year. We were considering this. Wyoming has a cutthroat SLAM, and we wanted to know if there was any interest in this concept, and if there was, you know, what species or species assemblages would people like to see in such a SLAM? So we asked, and these are in first to third. So the most popular response was native cutthroat SLAM. Number two was bass SLAM, and number three was pike SLAM. This is something that we're going to move forward with cautiously at first. We're going to move forward, I believe, with the cutthroat SLAM and see how that is, see how many people want to participate in that, and then move forward cautiously. So that sums up our survey. Now moving into our statewide recommendations. Like we indicated in the survey, we want to recommend standardization of our kokanee closures as follows. So this would be the language that we would recommend, that it's closed to the possession of kokanee salmon from September 10th through November 30th. This is a subtle change to what's already in place, both in date, and there's an indication that a red kokanee is, you know, you can't take a red kokanee. This would be all kokanee, because some kokanee don't turn red. They turn kind of a darker green, so this would be all kokanee during these dates. This would also include the Electric Lake tributaries, because they have a closure to possession kokanee just like the reservoirs. So this would come out, and this would go to the front of the book with all of our general statewide regulations and come out of the water-specific section. So that's all of the statewide recommendations, just the one. In the central region, we have three new community fisheries: Pole Canyon Pond in Utah County, Bartholomew Pond in Utah County again, and then Deer Valley Lakes in Summit County. These are community fisheries, and all of our community fisheries have the same regulation. It's just a simple two-fish regulation regardless of species. So these we recommend would fall into that category of management. Also in the central region, this has been an annual contention. Includes the strawberry the ladders. So there's been a contention about what is the ladders, and it depends on the water level. It historically has gone from I-40 or Highway 40 down to the water and down to the channel that contains the water at whatever water level. So every year, the change in the definition in our guidebook is different. And so we decided to clarify that from, and this is how it would read in the guidebook. So it would be the Central Region Utah Project Canal, so the steps, from the fenced-in area at the upper concrete structure upstream to the tunnel at Highway 40. That would be closed to fishing. That way it doesn't change dependent on water level. It's consistent, and everybody knows where that is. Okay, moving on to the Northeast Region. We had an illegal movement of walleye into Red Fleet Reservoir several years ago. We had a catch-and-kill regulation that was put in place for walleye, which is our standard response for these movements of fish. We plan on treating Red Fleet Reservoir the 13th of October. And at that point, so this upcoming year, we will have it stocked with fish and be back into management. And all of the general statewide regulations would be reinstated, and the catch and kill regulation at Red Fleet would be removed. In the southern region, this is a new kokanee water, and this regulation just incorporates kokanee into their trout limit. So the limit would be 4 trout or kokanee, regardless of species, and only one over 24 inches. And so we just added the word kokanee there. Again, in the southern region, Manning Meadow Reservoir, tributaries and spillway. This is one of our brood lakes for cutthroat down in the southern region, and there's enough cutthroat trout in there to allow some harvest. Not a lot of harvest, but a little. And so as such, we'd like to recommend a 2 trout limit regardless of species, but artificial flies and lures only, and close during the January 1 through the second Saturday in July. And that is all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to go ahead and move now to questions from the public regarding the presentation. Seeing none, we'll move to the RAC. Questions from the RAC. Craig.
Yeah, where are the Deer Valley Lakes in Summit County?
They're up at the top. They're on the Park City side of Deer Valley Lakes. And just some little pothole lakes. And they've been treated as community fisheries now for 2 years. And so they're kind of experimental now. We want to move full-time into community fisheries management there.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, moving to comments from the public. I don't have any comment cards, but anybody has any comments? Comments from the RAC. Russ.
Well, Drew and Paul, I just want to, you know, tell you thanks for managing well, and for all the aquatic biologists out there. I mean, been fishing quite a bit with my family, and always had success and a lot of fun, and it's been wonderful. And the comments that I get back from the public, and quite a few, a lot of them being stream fishermen, love it. So, good job.
Any other comments from the RAC and or motion?
Mr. Chair, yep. I would like to, what do? We accept or approve the warm water fisheries program as presented.
Okay. Second?
I second that motion.
Second by Chris. Discussion? Any questions or comments on the motion?
It's the whole one. We're not doing two. Are we doing both?
That includes your whole presentation, warm water and cold water?
Yeah, it's just the sport fish regulations.
That's. I was wondering, because I think all water is warm now, isn't it?
It is this summer.
Yeah. Okay, so it's been moved and seconded that the RAC accept the fishing guidebook and rule R657-13. Are we ready for the question? Okay. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Opposed? It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. Okay, the next item on the agenda is an informational item, and it's on hunting technologies discussion by Sergeant Mitch Lane. Sorry, Rick Olson.
Okay, well, you kind of corrected there. I'm not Mitch. My My name's Rick Oltz, and I'm a captain with the enforcement section. And you got to listen to me last month. I'm back. This is going to be a little louder. Okay, the purpose of this, my presentation today, is informational only. And we're going to look at some of the Western states regulations. We're going to look at some technology advances. And the most important part, I think, is we're going to present some survey results of a survey that we put out there. As I said, this is informational only. We have no proposal. We're just looking for the public's input. These issues are social issues. They're not biological in nature, meaning whatever's decided doesn't really affect the population. Each year, we get more and more questions from the public about weapon types. This last legislative session, we had a legislator that actually ran a bill to allow crossbows during the archery hunt. The division promised this legislator that we would take this issue to the public and through the public process and let it play out that way. We would prefer that than have it legislated. This issue has not been looked at for at least 10 to 15 years. And when you get into comparing different states' regulations, we found it's really difficult to compare apples to apples. A big part of that is that each state has a different type of hunt structure. So we did the best we could in comparing, but it's not always apples to apples. Okay, a big part of this was our hunter survey that we sent out. This was an online, by email invitation only, to 77,000 2014 general season deer and elk hunters that were at least 18 years old. The survey was open from July 27th to August 16th. Each question had three answers: a yes, a no, or a no opinion. Trust me, people have an opinion on this. 19,000 survey responses. Not to knock the fish guys, but 1,800 is a pretty good sample. We had 19,000 respond. The highest number of responses the division's ever had to a survey. Okay, now this graph right here breaks down the percentage of the respondents by the weapon choice that they typically hunt with. So initially when we sent this out, we thought that we would have to present the results based on weapon type. Or in other words, we thought archery hunters would think one way, muzzleloader hunters would respond a different way. As it turns out, that was not the case. It didn't matter. It was within a percentage point. So we're going to present the results all together. Okay, the first issue that we looked at was allow the use of a draw lock. Okay, of the 16 states that we looked at, and I'll show you a map in a little bit that shows you what states that we looked at. Three allow draw locks, 10 do not. Utah's a no, and three are silent. And this is where it gets difficult with the other states. In some states, if it's not in their regulations, you can't use it at all. In other states, if it's not there, you can use it. Okay, we ask our hunters, should draw locks be allowed on bows during the archery season? Now, you all know that last year we changed it. You can use a draw lock on a bow on any legal weapon season. But this question was directed, should we allow it during an archery season? 69% said no. The next issue we looked at with archery is magnifying scopes on bows. Seven states do not allow it. Eight are silent on it. In Utah, we do not allow currently a magnifying scope on a bow. We ask our hunters what they thought. 70% of the hunters do not want magnifying scopes on bows. Okay, we didn't survey the states on rangefinders. Most states define it as electronic. You either can put electronics on a bow or you can't. But we ask our hunters, should rangefinders that are attached to bows be allowed during the archery hunt? 60% said yes. They don't want scopes, but they do want a rangefinder on a bow. Okay, probably the biggest hot button and where we get the most questions is on the use of crossbows. So we looked at these states. The states in the green, you can use a crossbow during an archery season. States in the blue, you cannot. We ask our hunters, should crossbows be allowed during the general season archery deer hunters? 60% said no. We ask them, should they be allowed on the elk hunt? Again, 60% said no. Should they be allowed on a limited entry archery hunt, whether it's deer, elk, or pronghorn? 56 said no. Then we ask them, if crossbows were allowed during an archery hunt, should a magnifying scope be allowed on that crossbow? Almost 70% said no. Okay, moving on to muzzleloaders. States in the green allow a magnified scope on a muzzleloader. States in the blue do not. Utah does not, except with a COR. We ask our hunters, should magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders be allowed during the muzzleloader hunting season? 57% said yes. Now, they currently are allowed, just like on the draw locks or the crossbows. You can use a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader during any legal weapon hunt, but not on the muzzleloader hunt. But according to the survey, the hunters want to be able to do so. Okay, rifles. 7 states have no minimum calibers. 4 states require 22 caliber or larger. 5 states require 24 caliber larger. And Utah is just a center fire with an expanding bullet. Now, we didn't ask as part of this survey a question on minimum calibers on rifles, because we seldom, if ever, get a question, can I shoot my animal with a 22? Maximum calibers. There's only 2 states right now that currently regulate the maximum caliber. North Dakota has a maximum caliber of 49, and Idaho, interestingly, they limit it by the overall weight to 16 pounds. So a 50 cal gun is outlawed in Idaho, but they did it by weight for some reason. We ask our hunters, should hunters be allowed to use very large caliber firearms during hunts, 50 cal or bigger? Overwhelmingly, they said no. 71% said no. Should hunters be allowed to use rifle-mounted range-finding scopes? Now, these scopes are, the only one I'm aware of is the Burris Eliminator, but it does not cast a visible beam of light, but it is a rangefinder built into the scope. We ask our hunters if they wanted to use those. 60% said yes. I think we have an aging population that wants to see better. Okay, new technology, smart guns. Smart guns are a computer-aided aiming technology that's attached to the gun. No Western states currently prohibit these. Do you guys know how these work, or have you seen these at all? If you go to a website called trackingpoint.com, you can see how these work. Basically, at some point, you have to put a red dot onto the target, at which point you push a button that's called tagging it. After that, the gun takes over. All you have to do is get close with that dot, and the gun will fire on its own when it's... You never miss. I mean, you'd miss if I pointed this way and the animal was this way, but it's pretty impressive. Utah does not regulate those right now. They would be legal to use in Utah. We ask our hunters, should these smart guns be allowed in Utah? 84% no. You never get an 84%, or even in the 80s, seldom on a survey. So in the summary, according to our Utah hunters, they do not support the use of crossbows. They do support rangefinders on traditional bows and scopes on muzzleloaders, variable powered scopes. And they absolutely do not support large calibers or smart guns. That's all. Any questions?
Great. Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, I'd like to welcome Director Sheehan. Thank you for joining us tonight. Do we have any questions from the public regarding the presentation? Questions from the rack? Yeah, Bryce.
When are you going to look at making some proposals, I guess, then, to bring before?
We'll be prepared to, in the November round of RAC and board meetings, to have a proposal for the coming year.
I think I missed what you said at the beginning of the presentation. Did you say that the different constituencies were analyzed separately and you found no difference and so you pooled them? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought. Any other questions from the RAC? Comments from the public? Okay. Can you fill out a blue card? Can you use the microphone? We are recording it, sorry. And then I'm going to ask you to fill out a blue card after you finish. Thank you.
I just want to say thanks to the department for doing the survey. I actually enjoyed doing it, and it was good seeing the public's input into it.
Can you state your name?
Troy Burgess.
Thank you. Any other comments? Comments from the RAC.
I just have one quick question. So on those proposals or those on your presentation, those that weren't supported by the public, will we see those again as part of the stuff in November, or is that just off the table?
Well, the survey results, you mean?
Yes.
Or
with the proposals that Bryce asked about?
Well, when we do a proposal, I'm not sure if we'll work these results into our proposal. We probably will.
I guess to clarify, the ones that weren't supported by the public, will those just go away, or will those be presented again?
Well, that'll be determined by...
Well, I'm hoping, like, when they do the proposal, it'll say no 50 caliber guns will be allowed to hunt. You know, so the ones, obviously, the public over, yes, supports not having them, so that's how they'll address each one of them.
Thank you.
Yeah. The purpose of this round is to put this information out there. We've gathered public comments through the survey, but we'd also be interested in hearing what the RACs feel, what the Wildlife Board feels.
Any other comments from the RAC? John Blaser.
I'd just like to comment a little bit about the crossbow process right now. Speaking firsthand, I tore my shoulders up a few years ago, and I went through the process for the, I don't know what they call the disability, to be able to use a crossbow during the archery season. I did that for 3 years, and it became a pain in the neck to me to have to drive all the way to Salt Lake to renew my paperwork every year in order to do that. When you only hunt archery for 2 days during the season, it's pretty tough to dedicate another day to drive all the way to Salt Lake and stand in line to be able to get your COR, whatever it was, paperwork filled out so that I could actually get the crossbow permit. If crossbows are not going to be allowed, I would like to see a process where, I mean, you actually have to have a doctor's excuse or whatever in order to do that. If that doctor's excuse says that you're laid up and you can't use a crossbow for the long foreseeable seizure, I'd like to be able to see that COR carry over, or at least be able to do it online so that, or at least renew it online so that you didn't have to spend a day driving to the city. And that's fate worse than death in my country, to have to drive to Salt Lake. So.
I don't disagree with you.
Anyway, that's my comment about it. Their crossbows are great things for people that can't pull a bow back.
Yeah, we can look into that. I thought that you could do that through a regional office. I didn't think you had to go to Salt Lake, but I could be wrong there. But we can look into.
My other choice there is to drive to Ogden, and that's another half hour. So.
We can look into that. I don't know if there's a possibility to have something like that online, or to have a multi-year. We'd have to look at the law that allows CORs to see if a multi-year COR could be allowed in a situation like that.
It just makes it difficult for those who can't use a bow anymore to be able to qualify.
Oh yeah, crossbows have their place, I think. It allows some hunters that couldn't hunt archery any other way to be able to hunt with an arrow.
Okay, any other comments? Yeah, Justin.
Has there been any any statistics or anything that show the kill, like as far as the harvest, if the traditional archery compared to a crossbow, what?
No, we didn't look at that. It's really hard to compare. If you look back at the states, that allow crossbows, and we just looked at the western states, but even those western states, primarily those states, are white-tailed deer states, and for some reason crossbows are more popular in whitetail country. I think because you're hunting out of tree stands a lot, you're not walking as much, you know, it's not as open country. But what would happen on the success rate, we don't know. Obviously, if these were allowed and the success rate did skyrocket, then we'd have to look at permit numbers to compensate for that. But that's still an unknown.
Any other comments?
I have one more comment, and this is just from observation that I see from being out in the woods all summer. It might be interesting next time you do a survey to ask archery hunters how many deer they hit before they harvest one. That's a concern I have with archery hunting, is the number of deer I find dead in the woods.
Matt, did you have a comment?
I had a very similar question about magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders. Are you moving in a direction right now on your opinion on that?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
On allowing the use of scopes for muzzleloaders. Does the division have a direction that they're going with that?
No, this is totally informational right now. We'll come back to you in November and tell you what we think.
I have one question. Rick, on the survey to the public, was it specific to medical circumstances in regard to the use of the crossbow?
No.
Or was it just crossbow in general?
Crossbow in general.
Okay,
the question
so it
was
wasn't
worded, so do you support anybody being able to use a crossbow during an archery hunt?
Thank you, Rick.
Russ, did you have a...
Well, I just wanted to go back to the magnified
scope on the muzzleloader thing. I've been opposed to that for years, you know, I mean, when it first came up many years ago. And the public, or the, you know, the people that I talk to and talk about muzzleloading and so forth, it seems like more and more people are leaning that direction and wanting that. And I keep trying to talk them out of it and so forth. But I'll also tell you, you know, I've had a daughter that's taken 4 shots with a muzzleloader that hasn't hit anything, luckily. And I'm thinking maybe a scope like that might help her. You know, I think people need to know their distances still. You know, it's very important with the muzzleloader. And I'm worried that if you just say magnifying scope, it might give them too much of a leash, if you will. So I think there needs to still be some limits on what that magnification should be. But anyway, that's just my opinion.
I have another comment on that also.
Okay, Justin, and then Chad.
Okay, my understanding is a 2-power scope is basically like using your naked eye. Is that correct? And then a 1-power scope that Utah allows right now is actually looking through further of a distance than that. And so just in a lot of conversations that I've had, even that magnified to a 2-power scope would make a difference and still would help with that issue without letting them go up and beyond that.
Right. I'm not an ophthalmologist, but I know when I look through a 1-power scope, the target looks smaller than just with my naked eye.
I guess I got a couple questions and more just informational. Is with my experience with the 1-power scope on a muzzleloader, basically all that gives you is a crosshair to look at rather than trying to catch the front sight of the gun. I guess the second question I have is more informational for me because I've never shot crossbows. What is the feet per second, John, of a crossbow? Are they shoot consistent with a regular compound bow, speed wise?
Faster. I think they're a little bit faster. The arrow is lighter and smaller, so I assume they're faster.
I've never shot. I was just more curious than anything because I've never played with
a
crossbow.
Did you get that?
No. I think they're a little bit faster.
Does a bolt from a crossbow, does it come like in grains the same as like an arrow from a bow? Is that how you buy a crossbow bolt?
Yeah, and I'm not a professional at it because I gave up on it after 3 years. It wasn't worth it to me to drive to Salt Lake to get permission to use my crossbow. So I gave up.
Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Craig.
Yes, I have a concern. I don't know if the weapon is the answer or not, but I'm concerned about animals that are hit, that are wounded, that are never recovered. And I don't know if technology would help that or not. I think that ought to be looked at, but sometimes with better technology, people still take bad shots because they think they can make shots that they, you know, all the weapons are progressing, you know, muzzleloaders are a lot better, bows are a lot better, rifles, you have these rifles that shoot 1,000 yards, but I think we need to look at having the regulations in place so that people are making ethical shots and clean shots and kill shots, and we're not losing so much game because they're not recovering the game. Just a comment. I don't know. I have any answers, but that's a concern I have.
Any other RAC comments? Since we're at this discussion point and we are setting a record pace here for tonight, Troy Burgess had a question regarding waterfowl hunting. And the question he's asking is the use of artificial material to simulate open water and illegal hunting method.
Yeah, we wouldn't prohibit that the way the regulations are written right now, as long as you can't eat the water.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. Thank you very much for the presentation, and we'll look forward to some information in November. Speaking of, our November meeting is our next RAC, and it's going to be held at a different location. So it will be at Weber State University on November 10th, same time. in the Student Union building, and please look on the website for the room number. It's actually going to be in the same room we've met at before, room 404, the top of the Student Union building. There is free parking across campus after 4 p.m., so you don't need to obey any of the signs that say no parking, except for reserve stalls. So if it's not a reserve stall, you may park at that location. So that will be on November 10th. If there's no further business and there is no objection, the meeting will be adjourned. There being no objection, the meeting is adjourned.